The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. We have another great interview for you this week, so let's get on with the show. Our guest is Bristol, that's in the UK, based illustrator Fez Inkwright, who has provided work for a wide range of publishing houses and TTRPG games companies. Her main focus lies in conservation, folklore, and tattoo design, with heavy occult and ethno-botanical themes. Fez has also authored and illustrated a number of books and cartomancy decks, primarily exploring the importance of plants and insects to the development of human culture and religion. These books include Bees, A History, published in 2018, Folk Magic and Healing, published in 2019, and her most recent book, published this year, Botanical Curses and Poisons. She's also been nominated for Eagle Awards for her comic book covered illustrations and more recently Kindred Spirits Emerging Voice 2021 Award. Talking to you. Thank you for making the time. Let's start with your new book, which is a glorious production, complete with an embossed cover and gold everywhere. I mean, it's a wonderful book. Never mind its contents, just the physical presence of it. Botanical Curses and Poisons, but I'm guessing the key part is the subtitle, The Shadow Lives of Plants.
Yes, that's right. It's got a good selection of plants in it, and not just the poisonous ones. It's got ones that have connections with black magic and old curses and ways that you can curse your neighbours and cast spells upon them. All this, a lot of history, a lot of superstitions, and there's some really fantastic stories out there. So there are a lot of plants that I just thought, I can't skip them out in a book like this. I have to include them.
What, you just mentioned one there, cursing your neighbours. What would a good plant for that be? He says, asking for a friend.
For a friend, of course. There are some brilliant ones. There is, I think one of the weirdest ones I love is actually a type of fungus. It's called the, I'm trying to remember this now, I think it's the yellow trembler. Mm-hmm. It's also known in Norway as troll's butter. And it doesn't really look like a mushroom that you'd recognize, but it's sort of a weird jelly-like, wrinkly, yellow fungus. And a brilliant way of supposedly cursing someone with it would just be to throw it at them. And if it struck them, they would be cursed. And if you wanted to break the curse, you would then take it and you'd beat it with a wooden stick. And once there was none left, the curse would be lifted. There's a brilliant mix of some really quite dark things in there and then just some truly ridiculous things as well. It's a good mix, but that's the way that history is. Some things are just quite silly and enjoyable. Some of them are a little more serious.
Well, I mean, one of the things that intrigued me was apples and the fact that the pip in the apple is poisonous, contains cyanide or something, isn't it?
Yes, no, it's an absolutely minuscule amount of cyanide.
Yeah.
So nothing's going to happen to you if you accidentally swallow a couple of apple pips. But it's a wonderful one to bring up because this is one of these plants where you'd look at it in the book and think, why is that in a book like this? But there is so much sort of history and stories behind apples, and some that are loosely connected to the cyanide in the pips that make it really worth talking about. So in that section where I talk about apples, and the cyanide in the pips is that there's this story about cider. Now, in the UK, obviously, there are two sort of big hubs that are very into their cider making. There's the West Country and there's Norfolk. And the difference between them, now, I don't know a lot about cider making, but the difference supposedly is that in Norfolk, cider is made by squeezing the apples and squeezing the juice out of them. Whereas in the West Country, they would take the entire apple and they're just grinded into a pulp. So cider made in the West Country would contain very trace amounts, supposedly, of cyanide, because the pips would get ground in with the fruit as well. And it used to be that agricultural workers would be paid some small amount of their salary would actually be paid in gallons of cider or whatever alcohol was provided from the place where they were working. And so there is a story that has spread that a lot of people in the West Country who worked on these farms would actually eventually go mad because of the trace amounts of cyanide that they would be ingesting in their cider. Now, one of the great things about folklore, it's kind of like modern day urban legends or internet sort of stories that have been spread around, in that chances are there's no real basis in the truth. I think personally that this story was probably told by someone who worked in Norfolk, who was like, oh, don't drink the West Country stuff, drink the Norfolk stuff because they're all mad over there. It'll make you go crazy. But it's wonderful because it tells a lot about people, or folklore in general. It tells about what's important to people, and it captures sections of history, not as they're told in the books and the documentaries that we ingest now, but from a very personal angle.
Yeah.
From a very sort of small domestic angle. And I think that's really lovely because you're learning a lot more about people than you really expect to. There's actually this brilliant quote that I like to roll out sometimes by Christina Hull, who is a folklorist. And I'm probably paraphrasing here, but it's something along the lines of folklore is a great matter of importance to those who desire to understand the nature of people and the intricate mosaic of circumstance that went into their making. And it's very true. I think it just tells something very personal and very important to us, to other people. And I really love that about it.
Yeah, I definitely think it was the Norfolk cider makers who spread that one.
It's all slander and lies.
Yeah, I'm in Norfolk and we actually have a cider club in the village where they make their own cider and it is pressed.
You're incriminating yourself. It was one of your lot spreading that story.
Yes. Yeah, there's lots of tales about people saying, oh, this is really good cider. What was the secret ingredient? And then someone, when they get to the bottom of the barrel where they've been drawing it from, there are the skeletal remains of a rat that's crept in there and been dissolved by it.
Lovely.
Yeah.
If it improves the flavour, why not?
Exactly. Yeah, they call it falling down juice because you can drink quite a lot of it and you don't get the intoxicated feeling, except for when you get off the bar stool and your legs just collapse under you and you fall on the floor.
I have fallen victim to that myself a few too many times. See, in contrast, I'm West Country, so...
right. Yeah. And there's another one that's fascinating is, because I say I've just been dipping in through the book, is the walnut and the fact that the walnut has its own defense mechanism against other plants. If you plant other trees close to walnuts, it puts out an acid which kills off its competitors. I mean, I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's not the only plant that does it either. And a lot of them do it in different ways. So the walnut kind of releases this very mild acid from its roots that kills off the smaller roots. Some plants give off a sort of a chemical into the ground. Some of them literally just make sure that their canopy, in the case of trees, is so thick that other things underneath it can't grow. But it just removes any competition around the roots to make sure that any nutrients in that part of the soil go specifically to the tree. We don't really give trees or plants credit for being quite so determined, I suppose.
Yes.
Being a little bit bloodthirsty, but I quite like that about that. And like you said, it's not something that a lot of people consider. Like, even if you grow walnuts or you pass a walnut on your local walk, you'll probably realize that nothing really grows around the base. But no one really thinks too much about exactly why that is. And that's half the fun that I've had in writing these books, I think, is trying to sort of raise awareness of exactly how plants work from a more fun point of view by telling the stories about them and some of the legends and some of the superstitions that have risen up about them.
Yes, because I mean, you have another book out earlier called Folk Magic and Healing, which that's really about, among other things, all those plants you regard as weeds actually have potential medicinal purposes.
Yes, so that was the first book that I wrote. And it, as you say, it was very much focused on medicinal plants and the values that they have. But it's nice, actually, you mentioned about them being weeds. I quite like that word. A lot of people use it as a negative word, but I love weeds and I love hedgerow plants. And growing up, I've always had like a very strong interest in conservation. Mm-hmm. And especially here in the UK. And I realized that, you know, my books have been sold all over the world. So I try to give a more global sort of bent to a lot of them. But Folk Magic was very much an English book. And what I really wanted to do was to encourage an appreciation of the plants that we have at our roadsides, in our weedy areas of our gardens, in the hedgerows, because they're so important for the sustainability of this country. And there are some incredible plants out there that a lot of people just pull up without thinking, or they'll see them growing at the side of the road and think, oh, it's just a weed. But you don't realize that potentially, you know, in Roman times, they were actually intentionally brought into the country because they had such value to the armies, or ones that have actually properties to them that are still used in cancer medication nowadays, or that sort of thing. I think it's really important to raise an awareness of a lot of the plants that we see every day and just don't really think about. Mm.
Which were the ones the Romans brought in there? I mean, I know they brought in rabbits and various other bits of nature, but what plants did they bring in?
Oh, they bought lots. A majority of plants in the UK were probably brought in by them. The ones I can bring off the top of my head were nettles. So they actually brought nettles with them wherever they travelled and planted them along the way so that they would have access to them. And not only are nettles incredibly nutritious, they're full of vitamins and a lot of... they've got a lot of... value in terms of eating them. You still get places that make nettle soup and nettle porridge. But they also are very good for creating poultices for skin complaints, rashes, and obviously where they would be wearing their armor and it would be rubbing, you know, areas of rubbing at their skin or sore feet where they're walking, they would use them to create poultices. They would also use them as they moved up north, and especially into the UK, and our weather is terrible. They were very, very cold. They would take handfuls of nettle and rub them all over their skin. And the stinging of the hairs would warm their skin back up. And it was right. Very extreme cold to actually fend off that sensation of freezing.
Right, right. Macho bunch, these Romans then.
Exactly. They also brought lavender with them as well. Because lavender obviously is very valuable in terms of it's an antibacterial. And it's very calming as well. So at the end of very stressful walks or campaigns, they would use the oil in their bathing, and they would use it in, again, their medical care as well. So that's another plant that was very much spread throughout, not just the UK, but throughout Europe as they travelled with them.
Oh, where do nettles originate then? I mean, we've got them everywhere. They just grow and they grow and they grow.
They do, and I have no idea.
Oh, right.
I don't actually know. All I do know is that they were carried by the Roman army. But I'm not, like you say, you see it everywhere. I'm not actually sure where they originally come from. But I mean, they're widespread, not just across Europe, but across, you know, Africa, North America, I think even Asia, you get the common nettle.
Yeah.
And likely a lot of that spreading wasn't even due to travellers or roams. It's probably just naturally come in, either it spread itself or birds or, you know, plants are canny. They have a way of spreading themselves. And especially, I think that's why a lot of plants become known as weeds as well, is just they're very hardy.
Yeah.
And they can adapt to a new area very, very quickly. And so obviously we see them everywhere and think they must be, they are invasive, I suppose, but they still have this, these really important uses. Mm.
Yes, I mean, what I'm conscious of, well, a couple are obviously mint and lemon balm, which very very similar to nettles in the sort of long roots that spread out and send out fresh shoots. And once you've got them established, they just take over if you're not careful. Yeah. So what got you interested in, you've mentioned you're interested in conservation, but what got you interested in botany and the two topics you've written books about? What piqued your interest?
A bit of everything, really. I think my interest in plants, and linking back to my interest in conservation as well, is very much to do with my childhood. I grew up in the countryside, or right on the edge of a town where it was very easy to get into the countryside from there. And my mum is a gardener as well, and she's always had these absolutely beautiful gardens.
Yeah.
And so I was always seeing her out there and working in them, and as a child being out there. And she used to take me on walks through the woods and around the lakes. And so I was always surrounded by plants, and she would always point out what they were and give them names and, you know, warn me which ones not to lick my hands after touching, and all the usual warnings you have to give to a child. So for me, plants were always a constant surround. And I think in terms of the interest in the slightly more esoteric in early religions and folklore, it's always been there. I've always been interested in stories, and especially stories that are connected to things that I am surrounded by. I think my first real seed in terms of just sort of linking back to the books that I've written with Folk Magic and Healing, which is about medicinal plants. When I was a child, I was quite an avid reader, and I absolutely loved these series of books by Brian Jacks called the Redwall series. And he himself was very into writing sort of poetry and songs, which he featured in the books. And there was a character who was a healer. Mm-hmm. And she had this little song that she would sing about all the different plants and what they could be used for, like, you know, which ones would be used for headaches, which ones would be used for injuries. And at first, I think I just kind of assumed, well, that's, you know, that's just written for the book. You know, that sounds like magic to me. That doesn't sound like a real thing. And then when I realized actually that all of the plants and all of their uses mentioned there were actually real, that they did actually have those properties, for me, it was like this eye-opening thing where I suddenly realized that these plants that I've been surrounded by growing up were not just pretty, and they weren't just, you know, food for birds and for pollinators. Suddenly they had this use to them that I, you know, that we as humans could use. And I thought that was fascinating. And the more that I started noticing that, the more I started paying attention to it, I realized that there were stories and folk stories everywhere I looked, really. I mean, the area that I grew up in Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And there's a village near to where I grew up called Vernham Dean, which is supposedly haunted by ghosts who died during the plague in 1665. And the people who first came down with this plague were told to isolate themselves on a nearby hill. And they were promised that if they did so, that they would be brought food and water and, you know, allowed to survive so long as they stayed away from others. And so they all went there in good faith, and then they were abandoned by the rest of the village and they died. And, you know, it started this tradition of running 7 laps around the hill each year to appease them and to stop this curse from coming down on the village. And, you know, you suddenly, the more that you look into the stories and the history of the area, you suddenly realize that these tales still exist. And, you know, I don't know how many people still do this run around the hill, and I don't know exactly how accurate, you know, whether it was during the plague, how many people supposedly did die in. Mm-hmm. I think I've heard a similar story about a similar village up in the north. So potentially, you know, one story has been picked up from one place and then attributed to another place. But even that in itself is really fascinating in the way that stories travel. And in the way that something about that story obviously caught someone's attention and they think, oh, well, there's, you know, I remember that story, but I don't remember where it came from. But then that in itself has been absorbed into the local, the local weave of the area. And so it just kind of came from that, really. I think the more I discovered things, the more I found things in my research, the more I just started finding myself drawn in particular directions.
You didn't study science at university or anything like that?
No, I didn't. No. I actually studied art at university. but I've, as an artist, I've always, my art has always taken on a slightly weird bent to it.
Yeah.
And I think that more that you meet other people who are, you know, who enjoy that type of artwork, and then you kind of get drawn into that community, and you sort of end up on, surrounded by people who are also interested in those kind of things. And so it's never been a case of I grew up knowing that this was what I was going to do with my life. It's definitely been a bit more of a meandering, meandering path. And it's only relatively recently that I've been able to do this full time, that I've sort of built a fan base that, you know, they're responsible for the popularity of my books and for, you know, supporting me in what I do. And I really appreciate that. But it definitely wasn't something that I knew from a very early age that was what I wanted to do.
Yeah, right. No, that's clear. It's always intriguing how people end up doing what it is they are doing. When and how they started out, and did they set out deliberately, or did it, to say, evolve or come about almost by accident? Yeah,
exactly. A lot of it, I think. Actually, I think it all started mostly when I moved to Cambridge for a few years, and that was actually the time when I started writing Folk Magic and Healing. It was originally going to be just a little pocket guidebook for people who were interested in healing plants. And when I started doing more research, one of my favorite places to go is that most libraries have a local interest section. Mm-hmm. And it's usually books that have been written by local writers. And you get all of your ordnance survey maps in that section and that kind of thing. But occasionally you'll find just really fascinating, very localized books about, you know, here's some of the local language, or here are some of the very local stories of just this one particular village. And I remember around the time when I was starting to research this, and I've moved all over the country, and I love researching the areas that I moved to, just because I find it's easy to feel connected to them. Mm-hmm. And I started reading in one of these little books about the history of the Fens, about this creature called the Tiddy Mun. And the Tiddy Mun was a harvest spirit, was a benevolent old man who supposedly lived in the Fens. And if people wandered into the marshier areas or into the areas that were deeper and wetter, he would save them from drowning, and he would keep the floods at bay. And there are a lot of stories about people leaving offerings to him and really kind of appreciating the protective spirit that he was. Yeah. And then in the 1600s, the Dutch drained the Fens to reclaim a lot of the land so that they could build on it. And around that time, the stories of the Tiddy Mun changed to become a very angry spirit who would actively lure people into the Fens and would actively create drownings and create floods. And I found that was really fascinating to me because it reflected the anger that was felt by locals about the changes that were being made to their lands without their approval. Because this was very much done without consulting them. It was just decided that they needed the land and therefore they would do it. And, and I really loved that. That really caught my attention. I thought that was a really interesting example of folklore and creatures being used to explain the changing attitudes of the people. And also, I think it was a great way, folklore in general, I think is a great way to explain things that people didn't necessarily have the scientific knowledge to fully define. Mm-hmm. So obviously they saw that the Dutch were coming in, that they had drained them, and then suddenly there were floods. So to them, they were saying, well, this must be created. This must be caused by the land being angry. But wetlands and marshes are a crucial part of our environment. You know, they act as a sort of sponge.
Yeah.
And they store water during heavy rains and they prevent these flash flooding. And so the draining of the fens removed that. And the increased number of floods that would have followed were explained by the locals as, well, it must be the Tidy Mun. He must be angry because you've done this to us. And I remember reading that story and sort of doing some research into it. And it just, to me, I think that was one of the very early things that made me think, you know, there's something really interesting here. And it was definitely that period at which I just thought, I want to write about this. I want to research more into it because I think it's wonderful and it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's intriguing. That tale's intriguing sort of example of history repeating itself, because we're now getting a situation where heavy rains cause flash flooding because we've not drained the land, but we've covered it all over with buildings and concrete and tarmac and same thing. So, yeah. Tidy Mun, where are we? Where are you? We need you back.
Exactly. I think it's fascinating. And obviously not all folklore is sort of serious or dark stories. There are some very silly ones as well, which I think are fantastic and just kind of fun to tell. But I think ones like that really drive home the importance of folklore. And I think the importance of collecting it and passing it on and telling it, because there was a revival around the early 1900s where, and you can see if you ever look into it, there are so many books that were written around that time because people were suddenly interested in it.
Yeah.
And you get some wonderful collections that are just, you know, specifically the folklore of this one particular town in this one particular area. And that craze lasted maybe sort of 5-10 years. And then since then we've forgotten it. So it's really nice to see a bit of a revival and these new sort of research into folklore arising and telling the stories again.
Yeah, because I say we often forget, you know, it, particularly nowadays, where if there's anything you don't understand, you just go on Google and look for it, that we were talking of largely pre-literate societies or very limited access to education. The parson and the squire would be the only people probably who could read and write. There was no media and no news. So these things did come out of the blue and had to be explained. And folklore, as you say, was the way the tradition, the memories, the lessons were passed on.
Exactly. And I think a lot of it was encouraging a respect for the environment, because we are at our heart, we're farmers, you know, that's what's allowed us to become as successful as we are, is the act of agriculture and farming. And so a lot of early stories are entwined in with systems to memorize what to plant and what's essential and when to plant it. But then a lot of it is also warnings about the dangers of the world. Don't go to this area. You know, don't go out at night. Respect this certain type of wildlife. You know, don't take too much of the fruit and leave some for others, or leave some to grow the next year as well. Mm. And I think these stories, as you say, to people who weren't literate and people who weren't able to just pop onto Google and check what they were doing, it's a great way to memorize the important information about how to ensure our survival.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, very much so. Let's talk about the other aspect of your work. You're an artist and an illustrator. The work you do with Crow and Crown for the tabletop role-playing game market.
Yes, it's, when you say it that way, it suddenly feels like, where did that come from? That's very, very out of the blue. But yeah, in my mind, it's connected. The tabletop community is great. I've been playing tabletop games for about 15 years now. And the nature of tabletop games is that it's very story-based, very narrative-based. And a lot of players love legends and folk tales and that kind of thing. So to me, it feels a bit more natural that I should be into both. But I can see how it feels a little bit like, oh, that's a complete, you know, come in from the sides there.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's for me, probably not for a lot of the listeners, but for me, because I've never been into games of any sort. As the old Bonzo Dog Doodah band song went, I was a strange boy at school who didn't like sport. And it sort of spread through to card games, the games you get at Christmas, everything. They just don't click with my mind for some reason. So it's one of those areas I've got a complete blind spot on. And, you know, obviously I was aware of the Dungeons and Dragons in the 1980s, but hadn't realised it was still such a thing. I say that's me rather than anything else. So that intrigued me. But you do sort of the character guides then, is it? Or
yes, so it's like you say, Dungeons and Dragons came about in the 70s, 80s, and it had a big heyday then. And as I say, I've been playing for about 12, 15 years now. And it's not just Dungeons and Dragons. There are a lot of other systems that have arisen to fulfill certain needs. For example, Dungeons and Dragons is very battle heavy, or it's a battle-based system. But there are ones, for example, Powered by the Apocalypse is another one that I play that's more narrative heavy, and it encourages the other players to contribute to the world building. And it's had a bit of a resurgence maybe in the past 10 years or so, where with the popularity of websites such as Twitch, like streaming, a lot of people have started streaming online their games. And so it's the same in many ways as reading a book or listening to a fictional podcast. It's just another way to access stories. But with the nature of tabletop gaming, because it's usually a story that is told by multiple people at once, you'll have one game master who tells the story, and then the other players are interacting, but they themselves can change the way that it goes. So it's a lot more collaborative. It's a bit more chaotic. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun, but it's definitely had a bit of a resurgence recently, and a lot of people are leaning more towards narrative games. So not just going into battles and fighting bad guys, but there are these really deep, fascinating stories that are coming out of it. And as someone who is a player and who runs these games as well, it's very easy for me to see where players are missing, I guess you could say, products. So for example, with Dungeons and Dragons, they produce these big A4 character sheets. And for me, I'm just thinking, well, I don't want to carry those around. They're going to get folded. They're big and they're messy. So I just started creating products myself that I thought would be neater, easier to pop into a bag. Sort of books where you can have all of your notes in one place without having to juggle a million different sheets at once. And I'm not the only person out there doing it. There are some really fantastic companies that are creating. You can get custom dice, custom figurines. There are some really beautiful products out there, and it's a really lovely community. Everyone's very supportive of everything that's being created for it. And I think that's really lovely to see. It's really great when something that you've been playing for several years has a bit of a resurgence, and suddenly you're seeing all these beautiful things being made that even as a fan, you're thinking, oh, I know I make these myself, but I could buy it from someone else too. And, you know, everyone's really supportive, and I love it. And as someone whose business is writing stories and retelling old stories as well, it's really great to be able to take the stories that I've been researching and telling and converting them into a way that people can continue to interact with them. For example, you know, there's a brilliant little tale I found about when people used to hang murderers at the gallows. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest fears was that the spirit of that murderer or the criminal would come back and would haunt people. Mm-hmm. And so when they buried them, they would take a willow stake and they'd drive it through their heart. And it was a way to make sure that the body wouldn't rise again and haunt people. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real thing that used to happen. And you can actually see around the country, there are a number of trees that supposedly have grown from these willow stakes that have been, you know, buried with the body of a murderer. And so as someone who's playing, you know, who's creating a world and playing this world with other people, being able to take little information like that and slot it in, it really enriches the world and yes. makes it feel more real. Mm. And so for me, the two, they combine really well because you get such incredible ideas from true stories that a lot of people aren't aware of real things because, as we said, a lot of people aren't, they don't have yeah. that same connect with folklore and with plants that we used to.
Yeah.
So it's nice to bring it back in different ways, in ways that people can really start interacting with it again.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an area not far from here called Lush Bush. And that takes its name from a supposed murderer and suicide in the 17th century, a character called Lush, who was buried with a stake through his heart, and it grew into a bush. And the area, you know, became a burying ground for suicides and things, and various bits of folklore popped up about it. And, you know, the person who chopped down the tree went mad, and all of these sort of tales. But it's just a few words on a map, but there's a whole world of weirdness that is completely alien to us now lurking behind it.
I think that's what I love, is that it's a great way to interact with the history of an area. Like, obviously, you know, through knowing about Lush Bush, you know that that area was potentially where they hung or buried people. And and there's one I passed recently while I was driving out to Salisbury, and I think it's just called Dead Sisters or Seven Dead Sisters or something. And I was looking at it thinking, there's got to be a story behind that. And when I got home, I started looking into it, and there's a number of different stories about it. And I think the reigning one is something along the lines of the land that is now that area had belonged to a woman who was the last surviving sister of several, and she named it Dead Sisters after them. And it seems so morbid and so weird, but at the same time, it's, if we didn't still have those signs, if we didn't still have the names for places, people wouldn't be looking into it and finding out where that name comes from. Mm. It's a fascinating way to reconnect with the history of an area that otherwise it's just on the side of an A road on the way to Salisbury, and otherwise I wouldn't think twice about it.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that we still have those little connections to our history.
Yes, the place isn't full of, like some places are, Councillor Har Bottle Close or something, named after some local councillor or whatever, as a vanity project. No,
we still do get those, but it's not quite the same.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. This again is going to see a bit of a lurch. You mention on your website that you also do tattoo design.
On
and off.
On and off. So I, with both of the books, they're both illustrated by me as well.
Yeah.
Because as I say, I have an art education, and drawing is kind of the first thing that got me into sort of more creative world. And a lot of my very early artwork was just woodcut style ink drawings, and obviously that kind of thing lends very well to tattoo design. And it's just been over the years that I've had, I've started taking commissions from people who would like me to design tattoos, and because of the stories that I've been preserving about plants, and also you had in the 1900s, the Victorians were very into something called floriography, which was the language of plants. So if you wanted to send a message to someone, you could actually compile a bouquet of flowers but you would choose the flowers based on the message that you wanted to send. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, you know, would come to me saying, you know, I want a tattoo that's, you know, I'm at a point where I'm starting something new. I want something about new beginnings or rebirth or overcoming difficulty. And so using those stories that I knew about the plants and also the messages in Floriography, I just started compiling tattoo designs that are very custom to people, that, you know, the stories that even the artwork itself is telling is based on the flowers that are in there. And that's been really satisfying. It's a big honor to see something that you've drawn permanently on someone's body.
Yeah.
And it's really satisfying. And yeah, that's really that where that's come from. And it's still something that I do every now and again. A lot of my work is, I have to turn down a lot of them now because I'm quite busy with my books and with other projects. But mm-hmm. whenever I do that sort of thing, it's lovely. It's really nice to feel like I can contribute something very personal to people when they want something designed.
No, I mean, again, it's one of those things you don't think about. They must come from somewhere. And coming up to date, you've got a couple of decks coming out of these tarot decks or playing card decks or what? Seed and Sickle and Citadel.
Yes. So they're not quite tarot decks. They're oracle decks.
Right.
Which are, they're similar in that they are both, they're both sort of meditative aids. Ways to ask questions and prompt yourself to sort of think closer about the answers. Tarot, obviously, I imagine a lot of your listeners are sort of aware of tarot and the history behind it, but it's a very symbol-driven system. A lot of the cards, because they have such a rich history behind them, there are a lot of symbols that have to be included in each card, and they have to represent very specific things. And so for a lot of people who are new to tarot, they can sometimes be a little off-putting because there's so much to learn. Or some people just don't necessarily get on with tarot decks because they find that they are quite complex. And so there's sort of a rising popularity in oracle decks, which are used in very much the same way, but they're completely separate from the history and the symbolism of tarot. So the Seed and Sickle, for example, and as we've been talking about, it's all based on the research that I've done for my books. So it's all about plants and their history and the stories behind them. So each card is a different plant, and the meanings of each card that you draw is based on the story. So, for example, one of them is Foxglove. And it's a legend I absolutely love. In Cornwall, there was a local hermit named Saint Nectan, and he kept himself to himself. He lived near a waterfall in the woods near Tintagel, in a place that's now known as Saint Nectan's Glen. And to support himself, he kept a couple of cows. And at some point, some thieves snuck in and they stole his cows. And so he actually left to find where they'd gone to get the cows back. And when he accosted the thieves, they sort of said, we don't want to give them back. You know, we don't have to. And they cut his head off.
Yeah.
And rather than die there, he was like, well, I don't want to die out here. Right? If I'm going to die, I'm going to die at home. So he just picks his head up and walks home. And supposedly where the blood sort of fell from his neck is where foxgloves grew. And the area at the right time of year is full of foxgloves. So you can see where, you know, he supposedly wandered through and left this trail of them, which I think is a fantastic legend anyway. I just think it's brilliant. But so for that card, for example, the meaning that comes behind it, it tells the story. And then it's all about doing things in your own time. Like, even if people are saying, well, you have to do this now, you're like, no, I know that I want to do this in this specific place under my own circumstances, mm-hmm. which is exactly what he did. So for me, it felt very natural being able to write this because all of the plants and all of the stories they tell, you know, they have their endings, they have their meanings in the stories. And for me, it felt like a really interactive way to be able to bring these stories to people as well. Mm-hmm. And so So all of the cards are based on these legends. And there's two ways to read them as well, because I'm a bit of a workaholic. And whenever I use tarot or oracle decks, I always think, oh, well, I'm hoping it's going to tell me to take a break. But then it'll say, oh, you should be working. And I think, oh, well, it's told me I've got to work, so I better do. So for me, like I actually ended up writing this in a way that each card has two meanings. And yeah. you decide before you do the reading whether you want something that's going to be encouraging you to be proactive, or if you want something that's more focused on mental well-being and mindfulness, that's going to say, you know, okay, we'll focus on this, but it's more of a holistic growth. And for me as well with plants, you know, plants have two sides. And again, with each story, I could create a different meaning for each one as well. And for me, it just felt very natural. And, you know, having researched and written about, you know, folklore and plants for quite a few years now as well, it just felt like the right thing to do. And so the company that publishes my books, Liminal 11, they publish tarot and oracle decks as well. And they basically said, look, you know, would you like to do one? We think you'd be really good at it. And so I just thought, you know, actually this does feel right. Mm. So that's how the Seed and Sickle came about. And it's actually, it's being published a month from now, I think. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that some people are getting their copies early, which is always nice, because you start getting little tags on social media, seeing people interacting with it. And that in itself is really satisfying, seeing people actually interacting and engaging with what you've made. Yeah. But with the Seed and Sickle, so Liminal do these like special edition boxes of their decks. And the special edition of the Seed and Sickle actually included a second oracle deck. And because it's a, you know, it's a little limited edition box, there's less pressure than to create something big and grand. And they just basically said, create whatever you want. And I was thinking, well, I don't want to create something else about plants because I've already done that. And so I got started thinking again about, you know, stories and the fact that I grew up on fantasy literature and the mm-hmm. fact that I play tabletop games. And so the Citadel deck, which is the bonus deck that comes in the special edition, is very much based on tabletop games and fantasy stories and the characters, you know, the characters within these stories. And that was fun in itself as well, because basically I created this little fictional city called the Citadel, and each card is a character that lives within the city. And so each meaning of the card, it sort of introduces you to the character and their story, and then which parts of that character potentially reflect with you or your situation. And that in itself was really fun, because that was more of a fictional project. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that. And I'm really excited to see how people engage with that one, because that one hasn't gone out to anyone yet, I don't think.
Fits in well, though, with, as you were saying, about your tabletop work as well. You know, it's all falling through into the same, telling a story, isn't it? Storytelling.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're storytellers at heart anyway, so people love a good yarn. Mm. And I'd really love to potentially, with some of the games that I play, actually try integrating the cards that I create into the games. I've seen people actually playing tabletop games based around tarot decks, or integrating tarot readings into their gaming as well. And I think that's fascinating. So I'd really love to actually give that a go with decks that I've made myself, because I feel like that would be really personal somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Just going back to tabletop games, for people who, say like me, vaguely remember people playing Dungeons and Dragons a long, long, long time ago, what games are there out there that people should maybe consider having a look at if they're wanting to get into or get back into tabletop games? You mentioned one of them, Powered by the Apocalypse, I think it was.
Yes. So there are many systems out there, and they're all designed for slightly different things. I think the great thing with there being this sort of revival of an interest in it, and I say that like it fell out of popularity. It never did. It's continued in popularity, but there's definitely been a fresh market coming into it. And so I think obviously you mentioned that you've been aware of Dungeons and Dragons. That's been the most popular. It always has. It's been the one that everyone knows as a sort of a brand name game. Mm. So in many ways, that one is, it's a good one to pick up, I think, just because there's such a large community. And there are so many resources with it where it's very easy to, you know, be able to pop online or to meet other people who play it, yeah, who can help. But at the same time, because it is such an old game, and it's been through several editions as well. It's now on the fifth edition. And because of that, it does get quite complex. And there are some areas where it's, unless you're very into it, it can get a little bit complicated. But there have been some brilliant ones I've seen recently. For example, I recently got one called Quest. And Quest is actually designed for people who are brand new to games. And it's been written in a way where you can play it with your children if you want. It's very simplified, but not in a way where it's to the detriment of the game itself.
Yeah.
But it takes all of the bonuses of a tabletop game and just simplifies it right down, so that you can build your character from the start to the finish in a way that makes sense. And it's very accessible. It's a really lovely little system. And I think that's the great thing is with so many people getting into it now, or people coming back into it when maybe they haven't played a tabletop since the 80s, and then, you know, they're suddenly thinking, oh, I want to get back into it. It's nice seeing people who've been able to look at it from that distance point of view and think, okay, well, this is a little clunky or this is a little complex. So actually, I think that I could tweak it and create a new system that makes more sense for people.
Yeah.
And there are some great ones. And like I say, they're all for slightly different things. So Quest is very much based on your traditional high fantasy, and a little bit like D&D. It's that very fantasy built one. But I've seen systems that are focused on 1800s, sort of Edwardian, Victorian times. I've seen mm-hmm. ones that are focused on criminal heists. I've seen ones that are focused on, you know, Wild West stories. So there are systems out there for everything now. And it's actually just quite exciting digging into them and finding, you know, finding ones that work for you. But I think, yeah, looking at some of these sort of lower level entry systems are really, there are some really great ones on there to work with.
Right. Brilliant. What projects have you got coming up next? Obviously, the book Botanical Curses and Poisons, relatively recent, just launched. You've got Seed and Sickle and the Citadel decks. What other projects are you working on in the near future?
So I have a couple that I can't talk about right now.
fair enough. So no.
Just to mention, you know, I've got ones that I can't talk about. There is actually one which I'm working on that I haven't mentioned to anyone yet, I'm happy to tell you a little bit more about if you'd like.
Yes, indeed.
So I've been keeping this under wraps just because I know I'm the kind of person where the moment I say, hey, guys, I'm working on this, I think, well, that felt good. And then I just never do it. So I haven't mentioned it because also I like to kind of build up a little bit of interest. But I am actually writing a supplement for Dungeons & Dragons at the moment. So it's not an official one. It is one that is self-published. So there's no NDA about it, which is why I feel like I can talk about it now. But like I was saying with this, with there being a great community, people are writing their own material for it to help people expand the worlds that they're creating. And I think that's fantastic. And I've supported a lot of them, but I've never really found one that is focused around the research that I've been doing for my books. And actually, Folk Magic and Healing started as a pocket guide for tabletop gamers who wanted to write, you know, a healer class or someone who was very into herbalism and they wanted to maybe, you know, put in some real plants or have an idea of where to start with the stories behind them. So I thought I'm going to write that as a little pocket guide. And then suddenly it went from me planning 24 pages to, you know, 160 odd, and it's a whole book suddenly. So I've always had in my head the fact that I want to go back to doing something tabletop based with it. And I've had a lot of people who've been getting hold of my book saying, yeah, I've been using this as inspiration for my game. But with the way that the games are built, they're very mechanical. There's a lot of maths and technicalities to it. So with people using my books for them as inspiration, they have to come up with that themselves. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually writing a supplement that is all about the foraging and crafting and use of plants. And it's very, very based in traditional folklore. It's got a lot of creatures in it that are based on traditional creatures like the Tidiman and like, you know, cockatrices. But the more local, the more kind of unknown stories and the unknown creatures. And I've got some incredible artists working on it. I've seen some of the early artwork for it already, and it's going to be, without wanting to toot my own horn, I think it's going to be an absolutely beautiful book. And that one I'm aiming to have out in February. Mm-hmm. So that is your first look into that one.
That is brilliant. Right.
That's absorbing most of my time right now. So.
Well, that's been excellent. Fez, thank you ever so much for your time, and good luck with all the projects you've got going at the moment.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Fez Inkwright. You can find her website, including examples of her work and an online store, at rossdottir, that's R-O-S-D-O-T-T-I-R, .card, that's C-A-R-R-D. She's also on Twitter and Instagram as rossdottir. As ever, there'll be links on the urbanfantasies.com website, as well as in the podcast and YouTube metadata. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.